morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Charles Falco, who is a professor of physics at the University of Arizona, who's going to be talking about the relationship between Renaissance art and optics, and that's related to an event that's coming up tonight at the Santa Fe Institute. Right now, I'd like to welcome Stephen Ovitzky. He is the director of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, which opens this Sunday, the 20th of July, and runs for over a month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mary Charlotte.
It's always great to have you. So, first of all, I have to ask this silly question, but you know, we talk about it every year. What is chamber music?
Chamber music is music designed for performance in a smaller room. And ideally, it's music that, the way Mark Nykrug, our artistic director, and I look at it, is that it's music for an unconducted ensemble of between one and, oh, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 players. That's ideal.
Unconducted.
Right.
So that's interesting. Why is it that you need a conductor for a symphony but not for a group of 10 players?
It's holding things together. It's shaping things. With a group of a quartet or with a group of up to 8 or 10 players, ideas can be bounced around in the rehearsal so that ideas of interpretation of dynamic range contrasts can be worked out amongst the players. Whereas with an orchestra, that would be pretty impossible with 90 or 100 players on stage. So that way there's, as the old joke goes, there's one person directing and 100 people playing as opposed to 100 people directing and one person playing.
Right, right. And so when you are putting together, and I know this is something that Mark Nykrug does and we've talked about it a little bit, but when you are putting together a season, how do you decide whether you're going to do the, you know, you might call them old favorites or you might call them cliches like the Brandenburg Concerti, you know, and challenging new music, which some people might call just unlistenably difficult. How do you balance all
well,
that?
Well, I can never imagine any of the Brandenburg Concerti as being cliched. They could be chestnuts or old favorites and the backbone of chamber music repertoire. But what Mark does is, Mark is wonderful at creating this wonderful balance that the festival has and that it's been known for internationally, and that is music that people know and love, like the second Brandenburg Concerto that'll be on our opening concerts on the July 20th and 21st. And then some pieces that are really delightful and enjoyable, but are maybe not known by most music lovers. And on our very first concert, we have Platero e Io by Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, an Italian composer, based on the poetry of Juan Jimenez about a man in Andalusia and his donkey. Beautiful, very touching stories for guitar and actor, and they're being done in English.
And then guitar and actor?
Yes. Jonathan Richards from here in Santa Fe.
Who is actually telling the story?
He'll be telling the story.
In English.
And Castelnuovo Tedesco wrote it with the idea that there would be a narrator speaking while the guitar is playing.
Very interesting.
And again, so you have the Brandenburg Concerto No. 2, that brilliant trumpet, flute, oboe, and violin concerto, followed by this piece that you've never heard before, but is absolutely enjoyable. I had a chance to listen to it a few months ago, and I was just really taken by how charming and beautiful the guitar music is, and how touching the story is. And so there you have something totally different, and then after the intermission, this big romantic cello sonata by Rachmaninoff with Lynn Harrell, one of the world's greatest cellists, and pianist Yujiao Wang, who's become quite a favorite of festival audiences over the last 4 or 5 years.
So that's an example of balancing the very well-known with the not known at all, or not very well-known.
Exactly, and balancing style differences. A 20th century piece, Platero e Io, with early 20th century Russian Romanticism, and then Bach's brilliant Baroque Brandenburg Concertos. And that idea of balance and discovery, favorites and discovery, something new, is something that is throughout the season that Mark puts together with all the programming year after year. And that comes down to pieces that the festival commissions for premieres, or that we commission with other festivals, so that sometimes the premiere might be at Chamber Music Northwest the week before we do it here. But we go into partnership with other music festivals and create new works, and we have some new pieces on the season this year that were also commissioned just for the festival and our commissioning partners.
What are some examples of that?
Well, the week after opening, on the 27th and 28th of July, it's a Sunday-Monday, my really good old friend Roberto Sierra, composer who lives in Ithaca, New York now, was commissioned to write a nonet. Nine players, a woodwind quintet, flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, and horn, plus string quartet. And there were 19th century nonets like that. He was commissioned to write a new one by our festival, along with Chamber Music Northwest and Stanford University. And that's for the Imani Winds and the Miami String Quartet. And the premiere will have happened, maybe about a week or so before we do it here in Santa Fe. But we're part of the group that we were the lead on commissioning the piece from Roberto.
So that's interesting. You work with other chamber music groups around the country so that you can basically, you're not all just on your own, raising your own money and doing everything independently.
Well, it's that plus. And the plus is that when someone writes a new piece, a composer writes a new piece, one of the things that composer wants is to have the piece played more than the one time at the premiere.
Right.
And by entering into these consortia with other festivals, we're able to tell a composer, if you compose this piece for us as a group, there will be performances in four different locations during the summer of 2008. And that's exciting for a composer. And then because it has that, it's in the repertoire more, let's say, more solidly, and then other festivals and other ensembles get interested in doing it because they see that it's been done multiple times. And so it adds to the repertoire, and that's part of what we really believe in at the festival, is to create new music for the repertoire.
What does it have to do to then become popular? I mean, does it have to have a sound that moves people, that turns people on? I mean, that's the problem with late 20th and 21st century music sometimes, is that nobody understands it.
I think people don't understand special effects cinematography, but they still go to movies. And I think that somehow with music, people think they must understand it before they can enjoy it. And the reality is that music is this sensual sound, and if you love the sound, if it's something that appeals to you, whether it's because of the instruments, certain percussion instruments, or the brilliance of certain combinations of instruments, you don't have to know about or understand the harmonic textures. It's, do you like it? And so I used to joke when I worked with symphonies that no one gives an entrance examination at the box office. And
I know, but I mean, a lot of people don't necessarily like it either.
Well, that's a different story. But liking it and understanding it. You can love something but not understand it. Like I said about...
Well, nobody understands Bach either. They just like it.
They just love it, yeah. And that's why we have Bach throughout the season.
Right.
But Roberto's music, for example, combines what you think of as 20th century contemporary music with this Latin tropical element that he brings from his native San Juan,
Puerto Rico.
And he has managed to create this brilliant musical language that's both serious, with the quotation marks around it, classical serious, and rhythmically and textually reminiscent of the tropics. And so he's been able to do that, and his music is terrific. He was composer in residence at the Milwaukee Symphony, where I was the president of the symphony for quite a number of years.
And we're going to have him on the show
in
a week or a week and a half or something.
Right.
Tell us about your own history. You started out as a horn player?
I still play the horn. I love to play, but decided that it was I kept getting asked to put things together. So I wound up for a number of years managing classical radio stations, and then right around the time I was 30, I went and became the both artistic and executive director of the Grant Park Music Festival in downtown Chicago, a big orchestral festival.
And so your administrative and, I guess, people skills got the best of you.
Yeah, it just kept, every time I wanted to go do another degree in historical musicology, because I'm very interested in 17th century music. Something else came up that was more of a management opportunity, and I just kept taking it until I wound up working with orchestras and had a lovely time with the Symphony at Grant Park, Milwaukee Symphony and Minnesota Orchestra.
So you still play. Do you play in groups? Yeah, do you play for fun?
I play for fun with a few other friends, some retired professional musicians from major orchestras. We have a little wind quintet, and we have a good time and play. And it's a relaxing thing to do, and it's a way to keep touch with what it's all about. And managing a musical organization is about the music. It's about doing everything in the service of that music. And so by continuing to play, I keep my hand on it and always remember how it's a tough go. I mean, it's hard to get up there and perform at such a brilliant level that our audiences expect. And in the first week of the season, we have so many musicians coming and 30 different pieces of music in the first week.
Good heavens.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Now, when people get a season ticket or whatever, is it possible to hear everything?
Well, some people do. We have a few people from out of town who come in for the entire summer to attend every concert.
Heavens.
And then there are people from here in Santa Fe that we see multiple times a week over the entire season. It's a destination event. It's recognized around the world as one of the major chamber music festivals in the world. And we have a national audience. We have a national radio series that's produced at WFMT in Chicago and distributed to about 150 stations around the country. And for the last 2 years, it's been broadcast by BBC Radio 3, which is the British classical music service.
So the Chamber Music Festival of Santa Fe has a pretty wide range outside of Santa Fe.
Well, not only in this country in the BBC, but for a couple of years, the Israel National Classical Music Service has been broadcasting it, as has the New Zealand radio.
We're talking to Stephen Ovitzky of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, which opens on July 20th and runs through the 25th of August. So there's a broader definition of chamber music than limited to, you know, classical, Baroque, Romantic, that tradition of music. You also have, for example, pieces by Paquito de Rivera, basically jazz pieces. You've got on Saturday the 26th a whole Cuban and South American program.
Right, and it's played by the Imani Winds, which is a woodwind quintet, or wind quintet, of flute, oboe, clarinet, horn, and bassoon. And they love playing music of African and Afro-American and Latin American composers, and they've made a number of arrangements of these pieces by Paquito de Rivera and Astor Piazzolla. So they'll play Libertango, one of Piazzolla's most famous pieces, but
right.
In their own special arrangement for wind quintet. So on at 8 o'clock at St. Francis on Saturday the 26th, they'll be playing a concert of really terrific Latin flavored music. Along with one of their musicians wrote a piece based on the life of Josephine Baker. So that'll be, it's called Portraits of Josephine. So that's 8 o'clock on Saturday the 26th.
Parading around scantily clad on stage?
Well, I think it will depict that. It may not be
It'll
that.
Depict it in a musical way?
In a musical way.
Ah.
But what's wonderful about the festival is that at 5 o'clock that very same Saturday in St. Francis, is an all-Baroque concert on our Bach Plus series featuring David Washburn, who's a brilliant trumpet player who will be playing the Brandenburg Concerto with us on opening night. And he'll be playing trumpet concertos by Telemann, Corelli, and Foch, wonderful Baroque pieces, along with a trio sonata for flute, oboe, harpsichord, and bass, and a Bach flute and harpsichord sonata. So within a period of a few hours, there will be an all-Baroque program with blazing, brilliant trumpet playing, and then Latin American chamber music played by a wind quintet.
That's very funny, because Latin music has such a rich horn sound a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, when you make like the three trombones you get in a good salsa band.
Exactly.
Yeah, these arrangements are terrific, and so I hope people get a chance to hear the Imani Winds on Saturday the 26th. But throughout that week, we have a noon concert series, and that's very, very popular. We have two noon concerts in the first week. Young pianist Yu Jia Wang will be playing a solo recital on Tuesday the 22nd, and then on Thursday the 24th, we have a program that has more guitar music by Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, solo guitar.
Right.
I mean, not solo guitar, but a small ensemble with guitar. And then Brahms String Quartet #2. So it's an
embarrassment of riches. Is it easier to get these incredibly famous and well-regarded musicians to come to Santa Fe because it's Santa Fe?
That's part of it. It's also part of it is that the festival has a 36-year tradition of high-quality music making. Our artistic director, Mark Nykrug, knows everyone in the business, as do I. And it's one of those things where people love coming here because they can play music that they rarely get a chance to play during the rest of the year, and they can play with colleagues that they often don't get a chance to play with.
Because, is that right? I mean,
well,
are you...
See, we don't bring in so many groups. We bring in individual players, and we form groups here. And so when...
Is that right? I thought you would bring in the such and such string quartet who played together.
Yes, we do that. We bring in a string quartet every week, but we often split them up and have them play... each the members of the quartet playing with other musicians that come in.
And they like that.
They love it. And then they play maybe one quartet, but they rarely play a full string quartet concert, except this year, of course, the Orion Quartet, which is finishing the second year of a cycle of all the Beethoven quartets. And they were on your program last year.
Yes, they were amazing.
Yeah, and they're going to, I think, knock everyone out once again with three great programs of Beethoven quartets in the middle of the season.
Now, Kaija Sarjaho is the living composer who is part of the Santa Fe Opera this year with her opera Adriana Mater, and I see that she is on the program as well in August.
She's composed a number of pieces on commission from the festival, and we invited her again this year, and she composed a piece called Serenatas, which is for piano, cello, and percussion. And
like trap set?
No, a large percussion battery of instruments.
And battery is a great word for that.
Well, that's the official, that's really the proper
batería.
Word. Yeah, and so she's doing that for the group Real Quiet, and she'll be here, but also the festival's getting involved with the Sibelius Academy in Helsinki, and they're having students here at a special seminar that she and the cellist Anssi Karttunen are directing, and Anssi is on our series as well, and we're hoping that this first go-round with students from Finland and from the U.S. here in Santa Fe, and then they'll be working with Kaija, and then coming to our concerts, and then presenting the results of their composing over that week at a special free event at noon on Friday, August 8th.
Free event.
Mm-hmm. Free event.
So there's a couple of those. There's a free Indian market concert as well.
That's right.
At the end of August. So do people come in? I guess people come in from all over the place just for this chamber music festival.
They do. Like I said, it's one of the older chamber music festivals in the U.S., certainly in the western states it is. And it has the reputation around the country as being the top of the top.
Yeah.
And so that's why people come in. They get a chance to hear so many great players and such interesting repertoire. Like I said, it goes from Bach to music that was composed yesterday, but in the middle, which is where most of the people have their interest, the range is great. Like you're talking about the chestnuts, we have the Beethoven septet and the Beethoven string quartets this year. And then we have pieces that are, we know,
those late Beethoven string quartets are crazy.
Aren't they amazing?
They're extraterrestrial.
Yeah, absolutely. And the performances by the Orion will be stunning, like all the performances were last year. It's such a wide range. I mean, this year we have this fantastic piano quintet by Taneyev, Sergei Taneyev, Russian romantic. And it's a passionate, big, full-blown piece. And on that same concert is Ravel's string quartet, which is so elegant and beautiful. And Schumann's Dichterliebe, which is the poet's love, sung by Laurent Nauri, who was the Falstaff at the Santa Fe Opera this year. And Mark Nykrug's playing piano. That'll be on Thursday the 24th at 6 o'clock at
St.
Francis.
That Falstaff is supposed to have been terrific.
Yeah. And Laurent's a wonderful singer. About 2 years ago, he sang Schubert's Winterreise with us.
Right.
And so on one program, one of the most perfect modern string quartets by Ravel, this incredibly passionate set of love songs.
So basically
Schumann.
What you're saying is you're putting us all through an emotional roller coaster.
Well, I'd say you're putting you through an opportunity to hear great music all summer, almost every night of the week, and on some days twice in the same day.
Stephen Ovitzky is the director of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, runs July 20th through August 25th. And for more information, people can...
They can call 982-1890 or go to www.santafechambermusic.com.
Stephen Ovitzky, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Charles Falco. He is Chair of Condensed Matter Physics and Professor of Optical Sciences at the University of Arizona, and he will be giving a lecture titled Art, Optics, and Human Vision tonight, Wednesday, at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, which is at the New Mexico School for the Deaf campus in Santa Fe, and this is sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Now, you and the great artist David Hockney have developed the Hockney-Falco thesis, namely that in certain paintings made as early as 1430, these paintings were produced as a result of the artist using either concave mirrors or refractive lenses to project images of objects illuminated by sunlight onto the canvas, onto the artist's canvas. First of all, and this is a very interesting thesis, before we talk about this, the art, something I never really thought to ask, but when were the mirror and the lens invented in the first place, and how were they used?
Well, in both cases, they predated the paintings that we're talking about by anywhere from hundreds to thousands of years. Now, specifically, reading spectacles were invented in the around 1350, so 100 years before we're saying that someone like Jan van Eyck used them. Concave mirrors were used as far back as antiquity, around the year zero. Archimedes is said to have used a burning mirror, a concave mirror, to burn the fleet that was trying to sack Syracuse at the time, or a few hundred B.C. But certainly the technology for making the appropriate concave mirrors is described in great detail, such that you could follow it exactly today, 100 years before Van Eyck.
So let's go to the works of art that tipped you off. I mean, what were the specific works of art that got you thinking about the relationship between the art and optics?
Well, this first started out as a visual discovery by David Hockney. He's an excellent artist. He knows his skill level. There were certain paintings, for example, Jan van Eyck's Arnolfini Marriage, around 1425, I can't remember the exact date, that's on at the National Gallery in London. And David did his student art training at the Royal Academy in London. So he's been looking at that painting for his entire career and seeing certain features in it that it wasn't like he thought van Eyck could have done it better than he did. It was, the skill level was just beyond anything he could conceive of any artist that he knew of. And so this has been puzzling him for many years, many decades. And then once I got involved with David, we extracted actually quantitative optical evidence from that painting that shows that Van Eyck used optics to project the chandelier that's in that painting, for example.
How is it that this was not known before?
Interesting question. It certainly was not known before. All the paintings that we examined are from major museums, the Louvre, the Prado, the National Gallery in Washington, and so on. And if you look up their attendance figures, you'll see that 25 million people a year attend those museums. And that's, roughly speaking, 25 million different people will attend next year. So it's not like a lot of people haven't looked at these paintings. But apparently no one ever asked the question. There wasn't the right combination of person who understood the art and understood the optics that could ask both questions. Could an artist have done this, and did the optics exist at the time to have served as an aid? And for whatever reason, no one ever asked the question before. And so, I mean, that's the nature of a discovery when you're the first to do it.
It's interesting, too, because I guess it takes an artist, and a lot of, I would say, probably most art historians are not themselves artists, to look at something and say, how could anybody have done this?
Exactly. Most art historians are not trained in art. They're not trained in science. They examine some other area other than the kinds of issues that we addressed, although this does step into the territory that they claim as their own. If you are not a skilled artist, for example, I'm not a skilled artist. If I look at a drawing, all I know is that the person who drew that certainly is much more skilled than I am. David Hockney will look at a drawing, in particular by an Angra, which really got him started on this, and thought, this is extremely realistic, but the drawing itself is not a natural size. It was too small. Now, that doesn't mean an artist couldn't draw something small, but as a David Hockney looking at this, that's a clue that the fact that it's so small, he questions, why would an artist have done this? And in that particular case, it turns out that the artist used a camera lucida to do the drawing, which forced it to be smaller than you would do naturally if you were just using the unaided eye.
So tell us more about the effects that are achieved by using optics in these paintings that couldn't be done just by looking at it with the naked eye. Well, you just gave one example of that. But for example, in some of the Renaissance painting, what could they achieve doing it that way?
Okay, so I need to clarify a point. We're not saying that none of these features could not have been done without optics, that a modern artist today conceivably could reproduce the features that we found. So we're not saying that. What we're saying, in fact, is that an artist like Van Eyck may have had the skill not to have used optics, but were able to extract optical evidence, in some cases, a variety of features within the same painting that all agree with the laws of geometrical optics to an accuracy of 0.5%, that would not have been done with the unaided eye. It's statistically impossible to have been done without the use of optics. So where optics would be an aid, in that Arnolfini marriage, I think many of your listeners can picture this, so I'll talk about that one for a second. There's a husband and a wife, and there's a small dog that's on the floor in front of them, and there's a complicated chandelier over their head and a convex mirror behind them. Where optics would be useful would be for that chandelier. It's sitting there. The husband and wife don't have to be in place. You can project it. You can work with that for as long as you need be, and it's very complicated, and we've shown the evidence that it was used. The little dog, optics is useless. The dog is running around. Anybody who's ever seen a little dog knows it's running around yapping and everything. Optics doesn't help you because it doesn't stand still. The fact that Van Eyck could paint that little dog so accurately that we can recognize its breed today, 600 years later, tells you he didn't need to use optics, if you want to use that language. But the fact that we've got this evidence in the chandelier shows that he did use optics. So it's important to keep those two points separate. They're logically separate. So sometimes modern artists will get a few types of very artists who have actually constructed an entire business model based on them producing your portrait exactly like the old masters did without optics. They're naturally upset that we're saying that optics was used by the old masters. But keep those two points separate. Where optics would be useful also, if you were a very rich woman in the court, and you had a complicated dress with very complicated pattern in it, and you're sitting with, there's folds and there's creases and all sorts of things in there, to take that three-dimensional complicated pattern and put it in two dimensions on painting is a very difficult thing for an artist to do. If you project it, it just makes your life so much easier. So the artist could have the lady-in-waiting deliver the dress all by itself. He could keep it for as long as he needed, and then add the owner's head and arms to it and create a portrait. And he could do that from real life without projecting the image.
Now, the a question that probably has come up for other people besides me in looking at this is the question, hey, if they were using projections onto their canvas, were they somehow cheating?
Yeah, that comes up a lot, but it turns out artists usually don't ask that question. People who don't have artistic skill do ask that question. These projections are at very high magnification, approximately 1:1. In everyday life, we're used to taking a camera, and you can take your digital camera, shoot a photo of your friends, and you take a scene that's 6 feet tall, your friends, and you reduce it to the imaging device that's in your camera that's, let's just say, 1 inch tall, half an inch tall. That's a very small magnification. It's a magnification of maybe 0.01. So the portraits, though, you've seen in museums are nearly life-size. They're half life-size. They're very large. The optical effects of depth of field and of brightness get to be more severe the larger the magnification. So, in fact, it's very difficult to project an image at half life-size and make use of it. And one of the things that I'm fond of saying is that if you thought someone like Van Eyck was a genius, you actually underestimated him, that he was much more clever than you give him credit for. He wasn't cheating by using a lens. He was pushing forward the science of imaging considerably.
Now, I take it you've reproduced these techniques.
Yes, every one of them that we've shown, we've reproduced. In fact,
and
if you go to my webpage, you can see videos of a few of the things that we've reproduced.
Right. It's a very interesting process. For example, the painting you were just talking about, the Arnolfini marriage, that has a convex mirror in the background. What is that all about? Is that the mirror or the kind of mirror that was used as the optical device in that particular painting?
Well, no, but what that mirror at the time when people had developed the technology to make convex mirrors, like a security mirror, what it does something very handy for you, is it takes a larger area of the world than you can naturally see, and it puts it right in front of you. That Gutenberg, before he produced his Bible, one of the things that he did is there was every 10 years a pilgrimage to the cathedral in Aachen, Germany, and he sold small hand-sized convex mirrors so people could go into the cathedral and you could see like large areas of the ceiling and the sides of the wall simultaneously by looking at the reflection in the convex mirror. So people were interested in the optical qualities of the time. What we're talking about are concave mirrors, the backside of it, and that one's too sharply curved to produce a image large enough for us. In fact, the degree of concavity that you need is very little. It almost looks flat. So if you go to the drugstore today and you buy a shaving mirror, a makeup mirror, that often they're double-sided. One side is flat, one side is slightly curved to magnify. Well, if you just kind of grab it, typically you can't even tell which is the curved side. You kind of have to look at it for a second or flip from one side to the other to double-check to make sure which side is up to see the magnifying side. That's because it's so gently curved that it looks almost flat. That's the degree of curvature that's on the mirrors that we found people like Van Eyck used.
We're talking to Charles Falco, and he will be at the James A. Little Theater tonight giving a lecture called Art, Optics, and Human Vision. That's at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. Now, do the mirrors and lenses that appear in paintings like this one also have a symbolic or metaphorical meaning?
Well, no, you're stepping outside my field of expertise. That, of course, they've had symbolic meanings in metaphorical meetings, but there's lots of discussion amongst people who, you know, someone will say the dog in this painting is placed there because it represents fidelity. Well, okay, fair enough. If somebody else may have some other explanation for why the dog is in the painting. You know, none of those explanations actually are susceptible to scientific test. And I'm a scientist. The kinds of postulates that we're making about the mirrors are subject to scientific tests. If this mirror were used to project an image, it should have the following artifacts, consequences of it, and we check those consequences. And so that's how we proceed to show that optics were used. And I should say, not to criticize radio, but I really do encourage people to come tonight because I will show any number of examples. We're talking about a visual story here, and I can say all the words I want about a concave mirror in a painting. If you see it, you go, aha, that's what he meant.
Right,
come
right.
And I'll show you.
Yeah, if I could hold the pictures up to the microphone and I would.
Well, I've been holding them up to the telephone here, but you haven't been responding.
Well, what do we know about the relationship between artists and scientists during the Renaissance?
Well, we use the term Renaissance man to describe people at the time. And it turns out Jan van Eyck was incorrectly credited for years for having invented oil paint. It was later discovered he didn't invent it. No one was really upset with the idea, but that would make him a chemist. If you invent oil paint, mixing the pigments into linseed oil and being able to put this on a canvas makes him a chemist. He was a Renaissance man. He was combining arts and science. I'm adding to this mix that he was also an optical scientist in this. So we know that these people at the time, Leonardo da Vinci is creating incredible paintings, but he's also making machines of war, drawings of machines of war, drawings of helicopters, drawings of parachutes. So there was not the strict job description regimentation that we seem to find today.
It's interesting that in looking for historical documentation about the use of lenses and mirrors, you actually found a lot of that in literature, like Chaucer, as well as other kinds of treatises.
And that's another thing that is fascinating to me, the strict compartmentalization of disciplines. So has led people, when reading a Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, you come across a description of Alizane and perspective and mirrors. Well, what does that mean, and who knows, and we go on. No one discusses this. Well, it turns out, now that I've discovered, I've published a couple of papers on this so far, Alizane was Ibn al-Haytham, who was a 11th century Arab scientist, who in fact is responsible for our modern theory of vision, that he was a pre-Renaissance man. We give Kepler credit for having invented the theory of the retinal image, that our lens in our eyeball focuses the images upside down, flip left or right on our back of our eyeball. His article, let's say, manuscript that postulated that was titled Amendments to Vitello. Vitello was a Roman Catholic priest who is also called Alizane's ape for having just plagiarized Ibn al-Haytham's work. So our modern theory of retinal vision, in fact, is a minor variation of Ibn al-Haytham. And it's funny that I, as a optical scientist, discover these things through my collaboration with a world-class painter, because I'm looking for documentation. And other people should have discovered this years before, seen this connection much before, if the disciplines weren't so narrowly defined.
Well, I think that's a very important lesson of the work that you're doing, is the extreme importance of interdisciplinary work and conversation, talking with people in totally different fields. How do you think artists and scientists and other academics can be encouraged to do this kind of cross-disciplinary collaboration?
Well, I claim that actually artists and scientists have the same job description. Our job is to look at some aspect of the world that doesn't quite make sense to us, figure it out, and then explain it. And an artist does the same thing. Artists may be trying to convey, say, the sadness of war or the futility of war or the ill-definable aspects of love. They're trying to examine the world and convey it visually to people. And scientists do the same thing. So I found that artists almost universally, with one categorical exception, have been very receptive to what Hockney and I have proposed. And the one exception is these people I talked to before who have set themselves up to produce very realistic paintings without optics, just like the old masters did. And so naturally they're kind of upset by this.
Well, your work does bring up interesting questions about what realism is, because what is projected onto a canvas using optics and what is seen with the naked eye, two-point perspective, one-point perspective, and so on, maybe aren't palpably different, or maybe are visibly different, but they're different. And, so what is real? What is realism in painting? I mean, these are issues that you bring up.
And these are actually extremely important issues that we, at the invention of photography in 1839, some painters thought, well, this is the end of our career, because before, you would have sent me as a painter off to Spain to paint the Princess of Spain to give it to the Prince of England to see if he wanted to marry her. Like, she's not very good looking. If you throw in an extra duchy, okay, I'll take her. And so it's up to the painter to convey the reality of the situation. Now we have photography. But now it turns out with Photoshop, we've just seen this now in the news just a few days ago, did the Iranians fire 3 missiles or did they fire 4 missiles? And you see another missile Photoshopped in. And there are many other examples of this where the photography doesn't provide us with a real situation. Even if you take the raw, unaltered image, you certainly can position yourself with a camera to hide things, hide some defect that you don't want to have shown. Is that reality or not? It comes down to, I would say, an ethical artist creating a scene could create a scene that might convey the reality of that scene better than any 20-megapixel digital camera, because they put in what really is there, and they leave out things that are extraneous to, that would distract you.
You've said that there's one category of artists that has been not very friendly to your thesis. What about art historians? Have art historians embraced this whole thesis of yours and David Hockney's and run with it?
I'd say largely not. Largely, art historians have been very unreceptive to it. I could imagine various reasons for this. One is that, I've shown, for example, in a certain painting that 6 equations and 7 unknowns, we calculate features to 0.5% accuracy and show that optics were used. Well, an art historian is not even trained in that language. So how do they deal with something like that? The other is that art and art history are different disciplines. And so here you have an artist, not an art historian, and a scientist, not an art historian, who have come in and said, okay, take this Jan van Eyck, Arnold Feeney marriage, one of the most iconic images of Western art of 600 years that any number of doctoral dissertations have been written on, and we haven't done infrared reflectography, we haven't done nuclear magnetic resonance, we've done nothing that you couldn't have done. We've only looked at the image itself, and we've seen something that you've missed. And it's not something minor that you've missed. You missed the fact that they were using optics 200 years earlier than anyone even thought possible. Well, if you're an art historian and you're sort of an expert on Van Eyck, you won't take that as a friendly observation, I would
say. So there's a territorial, sort of academic territorial thing going on.
That's been my observation of this. And I can understand why this is the case, that people from completely outside their discipline have come in and said, you've missed something that you should have seen. We don't phrase it quite like that, but that really is the case.
Now, how has this discovery or set of discoveries affected David Hockney's own work as an artist, if it has?
Well, it certainly has affected his own artwork. I've got several paintings I use as examples that he made shortly after we started working together, where he was incorporating aspects of projected images he wasn't actually projecting the images, but he was incorporating what he learned from projecting images into his paintings, and it had a fairly strong effect. He made several portraits of me that I can guarantee you he didn't use optics directly to create the portraits. But now, having already said that we've got to show the images to understand what we're talking about, I'm going to make the conversation even more complicated. Everything we've been talking about is about the direct use of optics. I project an image and I trace part of it. There's also the indirect use of optics, which is extremely strong. If you had never seen a projected image, and I project an image for you, I take your complicated three-dimensional world with a huge range of brightnesses and tonal values, and I compress it into two dimensions onto a canvas in front of you, and you see that, and you're a painter, that, I argue, would fundamentally affect how you create paintings in the future. And so that's the indirect use of optics, even though you don't project images, that you make use indirectly of this the way these images look. And so it ends up being fairly complicated. Well, David has indirectly used optics, since he's projected many images and we've done many experiments with this, and it's entered into what he's done. He's now painting the largest the largest landscapes he's ever painted. They're just gigantic. He donated one of these to the Tate, it was just in the news a month or two ago. I don't know, 15 feet tall. I can't even remember how tall they are, and 30 feet wide, where he's trying to, as he would say, the camera gives you the surface of a scene. He's figuring out ways to bring the viewer into the scene. And this is influenced, highly influenced, by the work we've done on optics.
We're talking to Charles Falco. How does this work fit in with the other work you do as a scientist? Is it a sideline, or does it fit into your other scientific work?
Well, it started out as a total sideline, and now it's become central to an area I work on in computerized image analysis that people have worked on, trying to have a computer analyze an image for 50 years, ever since the computers were invented, and have made very, very little progress. Our computers now are just orders of magnitude more powerful than they were even 20 years ago. Yet, if I took a photograph of you, scanned it into the computer, and then asked the computer not even to tell me who you are, just, is this a dog? Is it a cat? Is it a woman? Computers don't do that, in spite of all this work that's gone into that. Well, I would argue that the people who've been working on computerized image analysis have been approaching it from a way that I am not approaching it. They've been computer scientists and electrical engineers, disciplines that are not necessarily known for high visual skills. I've been taking the work of one of the world's great artists and incorporating what he's taught me along with mathematics and approaching that problem of computerized image analysis from a very different direction. Now, whether or not it'll be successful remains to be seen. I'm going to talk about some of that tonight as well, of where this is leading. But it's approaching it, thanks to this interdisciplinary collaboration, in a fundamentally new way.
Charles Falco is chair of condensed matter physics and professor of optical sciences at the University of Arizona, and tonight he will be at the James A. Little Theater, which is on the New Mexico School for the Deaf campus right here in Santa Fe, at 7:30, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for your interest in this, and I hope to see all of your audience there tonight.
We'll see you tonight.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.